We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the life of a man who has been called the father of modern American espionage. His name was Bill Donovan. To start with, he was a genuine war hero. He won the Medal of Honor in World War I. He was someone who was born into poverty but went on to make millions of dollars on Wall Street. Then Franklin Roosevelt picked Donovan to be his chief of intelligence, making him director of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. He wanted to become head of the CIA when that agency was created. That didn't happen. Certainly men who worked for him went on to head the CIA, and the agency itself was very much shaped by Donovan's ideas. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Douglas Waller, who tells the story of this interesting, remarkable man in a recently published book. The title of the book is Wild Bill Donovan, the Spymaster Who Created the OSS and Modern American Espionage. Free Press is the publisher. It's been out for a bit now and has done well, gotten a lot of positive attention. We're pleased that Doug Waller could talk with us. He's a former correspondent for Newsweek and Time, author of five previous books, including a biography of General Billy Mitchell. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. We hope people will be brief if you can. That just makes it possible for us to get in more folks and trying to be on the topic. But we hope that if you can do that, your calls will be welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And Mr. Waller, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And how are you?
Just fine.
Well, I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to know more about Bill Donovan and to talk about him on the show. What a remarkable life this man had. It just, even if, you know, he had enough life for several people, for sure. If you look at his life and business, his fascinating and difficult personal life, and then his life in the military and then in government service, what a remarkable kind of life he got a chance to lead.
Well, it is. And I, you know, it's funny. I've told people I would have loved to have been a reporter back in the 1940s covering Wild Bill Donovan, particularly when he headed up the OSS. And in fact, if I had been there, I probably would have covered him. Donovan actually liked reporters. He liked leaking to the press. He routinely did it when he was at the OSS. He hired reporters as propagandists and spies on his staff. And before he formed the OSS, he would travel overseas very often as a correspondent, filing stories to newspapers.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the remarkable facets of the story is that when FDR tapped him to start the OSS, Donovan had one employee himself. And he eventually built it into a very significant organization. But he not only did he have to invent it, but he had to go out and find sources of information where he could. And just the rather ingenious ways he tried to tap people who knew things, information that was potentially valuable, and to try to bring all that together. It seems that this was something that nobody had ever done before.
Oh, absolutely. Donovan liked to say that he began his organization from minus zero, which was really the case. It was really started with one guy, and that was Wild Bill Donovan. It was formed originally in July 1941, and it was first called the Coordinator of Information back then. A year later, it would be renamed the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. When Donovan began, he was really kind of like what I call a player in a pickup basketball game, looking for agents and operations and programs wherever he could find it. So, for example, the Phillips Lamp Company, it made lamps back then, sold them overseas. It may still be in business today for all I know. Donovan arranged privately with the Phillips Lamp Company that when its salesmen went overseas on overseas calls, particularly in Axis-occupied countries, they would slip him any information, any intelligence they picked up. the Eastman Kodak company. You know, in my day, they made the Brownie cameras. Now they, I think, they make disposable cameras. Back then, they had something like 4,000 camera clubs around the United States. Donovan arranged for Eastman Kodaks to send him the photos tourists had taken from those camera clubs, particularly of militarily important sites. Pan American Airways, another Pan Am. We've probably all flown on Pan Am. Donovan had a project codenamed Project Cigar, where Pan Am ticket agents in Africa were secretly contracted to provide him information on Nazis moving throughout the continent there. So again, in the beginning, it was all kind of ad hoc. But eventually, he built up a force of over 10,000 spies, espionage operatives, commandos, research analysts, support personnel, many of them scattered in stations throughout the world. Again, a remarkable achievement since he began with only one guy.
Yeah. It's also really interesting to look at the relationship between Donovan and Franklin Roosevelt.
It was a complicated relationship. Keep in mind, these two guys were political enemies back in New York. Donovan ran for governor in New York in 1932 on the Republican ticket. He was a diehard Republican. He believed the New Deal, Roosevelt's New Deal, was a communist plot to take over the U.S. And during the 1932 campaign for governor, at the same time Roosevelt was running for his first term for president, Donovan said some nasty things about Roosevelt on the campaign trail. For example, he accused him at one point of being a Hyde Park faker. Now, back then, those were fighting words, because Roosevelt claimed he was a simple farmer from Hyde Park, and Donovan said that was a bunch of bunk. Roosevelt, for his part, had surrogates go after Donovan, too, including Eleanor Roosevelt, who took her shots at him. So, you know, you fast forward to 1940-41, it's remarkable that Roosevelt brought Donovan into his, you know, into his administration in a senior national security job, particularly since Donovan was still an aspiring presidential candidate at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does seem to, and perhaps the reason is that both Donovan and Roosevelt recognized that in this period, the run-up to the war, they recognized the threat, and they recognized the fact that the United States really had this desperate need for this kind of information. It seems that not everybody else in Washington or in the military thought that, but the two of them thought that, and that maybe was the one thing that brought them together, and maybe the reason that Roosevelt, when he looked at Donovan, thought, well, maybe this would be the guy to do it.
Exactly. Roosevelt, Donovan, even though he was an anti-New Dealer, was part of the internationalist wing of the Republican Party. He believed, as Roosevelt did, that the nation needed to prepare itself for war. It needed to build up its defenses for the war that was looming on the horizon. So these were two very canny politicians who saw common cause, particularly on foreign policy. Also, Donovan realized the nation was really blind to what lay ahead of him. The nation's government overseas. It had no foreign intelligence service. Roosevelt painfully realized this too. The Army and Navy had small foreign intelligence units, but they were largely dumping grounds for poor performing officers. Very often it worried Roosevelt so much what he didn't know about what was going overseas that it would make him physically ill. So he liked to say, when Donovan set up his OSS, that Donovan was his secret legs, his eyes and ears overseas, who could tell him what was going on.
Our guest in this hour, Focus Douglas Waller. He is the author of a new biography of Wild Bill Donovan, the man who headed the OSS during World War II, and whose ideas really helped to shape the CIA when it came along in 1947. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller, so we'll get to them in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question dealing with the Japanese internment period that happened in 1942. And I've never seen what I'll call the justification for the internment in a meaningful way, but your book maybe relates to that in the sense that there was at least rumors at the time, because I was alive at the time, that that there were potential ships and so forth, submarines in the Pacific area, and that there were concerns that people that might be allegiance to the Japanese cause could have influence over contacts and so forth. And I was wondering if your book handles any of that, because it apparently starts at that period of the beginning of the OSS.
It's a good question, and yeah, the book does deal with that. You're talking about the internment of Japanese Americans here in the U.S. in internment camps. Interestingly, Donovan argued against the internment of Japanese Americans, and his senior people on his staff who were advising him argued against it. Basically, they said we were going to be creating a problem that doesn't exist now. We're creating ill will among the Japanese American community and hostility when it doesn't exist. He believed that by and large Japanese Americans were patriotic citizens, so he thought internment was a bad idea. Roosevelt went ahead with it. Ironically, then, Donovan afterwards would have his OSS officers go to the internment camps and look for Japanese Americans that could help the OSS with intelligence on Japan. And he was able to glean a lot of important intelligence out of the internment camps and the people who were there.
Ah, excellent. Okay, that is a much broader view than I've seen exposed before, and your book is very relevant for that. Thank you.
All right. Well, again, we're talking here this morning with Douglas Waller. It's the new biography of William Donovan, the man who headed the OSS during World War II, and the book's just out, published by the Free Press. And other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. As I said at the beginning of the program, Bill Donovan was a genuine certified war hero. He won a number of medals. Yeah, I think I read somewhere that he was the most decorated officer of World War I, or maybe the most decorated American officer. And he certainly won the Medal of Honor, which is the highest military award. Talk some about his service as a soldier in World War I.
He was highly decorated. In World War I, Donovan headed up a battalion in the what was then called the 69th Irish Regiment in New York City, a very famous regiment. He eventually became the executive officer of the regiment, the on-ground commander for it, and that's when he was awarded the Medal of Honor for heroism on the battlefield in the Meuse-Argonne Offensive. Donovan, according to the chaplain of the 69th Regiment, Father Francis Duffy, was one of the was the only guy that Duffy had ever met who actually enjoyed combat, and he really did. You read Donovan's letters to his wife Ruth. He says at one point that going out in combat missions was like going out trick or treating on Halloween night. He really got excited over it. The action that he was awarded the Medal of Honor for, he was severely wounded in the leg, basically shot through the leg, and continued to lead his regiment in some very fierce and bloody fighting during World War I. He was also a very rigorous and almost brutal trainer of his men before they went into combat in France, realizing that they would be going into a meat grinder. And that's where he got his nickname, Wild Bill. One time before they actually started combat, he was running his men through an obstacle course over hill and dale, through barbed wire, whatever, and they finally all collapsed in front of him, totally exhausted. And he stood up there and said, you know, what the heck's the matter with you guys? I'm 35 years old carrying the same pack, and you don't see me out of breath. From somewhere in the back, a soldier shouted out, he never figured out who, but we're not as wild as you are, Bill. From that day on, Wild Bill Donovan stuck. He claimed he didn't like the nickname because it ran counter to the cool, quiet, professional spy image he wanted to project. But his wife Ruth said he really did like being called Wild Bill.
Yeah, and this enthusiasm for being in the field certainly was something that carried through his involvement with the OSS, and he liked to be out there and in the various invasions the military was part of. He was there. He was there at Normandy, even though he had been expressly ordered by Eisenhower and the other top military commanders that he should stay away.
Oh yeah, Donovan liked to be out where the action was, literally from from the day until the day he died. And in the case of the Normandy invasion, he had been on the previous Allied landings in Sicily and Italy. His own OSS officers thought that was a horrible idea, that it was no place for America's top spy master to be at the front at a beach landing. You know, if he was captured by the enemy, he'd be a very valuable prize with all the secrets in his head. George Marshall, the chief of staff of the Army, General Dwight Eisenhower, the commander of European forces, thought they had Donovan banned from the Normandy landing, that he wouldn't be able to go, but he managed to talk his way aboard a Navy heavy cruiser and land at Utah Beach. He gets on the beach. He's sitting on the top of a Jeep. A German Messerschmitt flies by and strafes the beach, and he dives in the sand for cover. He marches inland, about 5 miles inland, gets pinned down with one of his aides by a German machine gun nest, reaches into his pocket to find his suicide capsule that all officers, OSS officers, carried in case they were captured, realized he had left it in a hotel in London, and was all worried that the maid would come in there and mistake it for an aspirin and kill herself. But he had a grand time, going on these beach landings, and there was seemed to be no way the command could stop him from doing it.
I think isn't it also true that his staff was concerned that one day he might poison himself by accident by confusing his suicide pill with an aspirin?
Oh, yeah. He had a joke he would tell his staff. He'd pull out an aspirin and a suicide pill and say, I can't tell which, I got a headache, but I can't tell which one's which.
He was somebody who, if you're looking for somebody who really rose from humble origins to greatness, he's certainly an example. Growing up, he was born into an Irish Catholic family in a poor family, and ended up, and perhaps it helped that he was a war hero, marrying a very well-to-do Protestant woman.
Yeah, he was born on New Year's Day, 1883, in Buffalo, New York's poor Irish First Ward. Initially thought he would become a Catholic priest. In every Irish Catholic family, usually the firstborn son was assumed he was going to go into the priesthood. Donovan eventually realized he wasn't cut out to be a man of the cloth. He went to Columbia University and became a star football quarterback on the Columbia University team. Then he went to Columbia Law School, worked his way through law school. Franklin Roosevelt, interestingly enough, was a classmate of his. Roosevelt liked to say later that he and Donovan were old pals at Columbia Law School, and Donovan said that wasn't true. Roosevelt was from a much higher social strata than a poor kid from Buffalo. He left Columbia, formed a very prominent law practice back in Buffalo, and then married one of the wealthiest women in Buffalo at the time, Ruth Rumsey, and then packed off to World War I, where he was awarded the Medal of Honor.
Mm. Well, did what was that really the when he and then when he came back, he was really determined to be a success in law, which he certainly was, and he made a lot of money at it, and that probably would have been enough for some people. The fact that he was indeed a certified war hero, was that sort of the foundation of his business and maybe even his social success?
Donovan was determined to make his law firm an international law firm, that would recruit business from all over the world. And he went all over the world, not only collecting clients and business, but also collecting bits of information, too. He wasn't a dry parchment lawyer. He didn't like, poring over legal briefs. He was a terrific arguer before the Supreme Court. He could turn on the Irish charm on the Supreme Court justices. But in his later years, when he still continued to head up his law firm after he returned from World War II, he was basically a rainmaker, someone who brought in business from all his international and intelligence contacts overseas.
Yeah. Well, again, in this hour, we're talking with Douglas Waller. He's a journalist, former correspondent for both Newsweek and Time. He's the author of several books, and his newest is a biography of Wild Bill Donovan, the man who was head of the OSS. That was the foreign intelligence gathering organization of the United States during the time of World War II. And the book is out now. It's published by Free Press. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, just before right before the creation of the OSS and before he was tapped to do this by Roosevelt, in the early 40s, he was sent to Europe on a couple of missions to try to assess the situation there. And it was interesting because this was at a time when some people, including the U.S. ambassador to Britain, Joe Kennedy, thought, well, the British couldn't stand up to the Germans and that they wouldn't. And Roosevelt, you know, wanted to gauge the extent of opposition in Europe and in Britain to the Nazis. And that was one of the things that he sent Donovan to try to determine.
Exactly. In the summer of 1940, Roosevelt sent Donovan on an unofficial mission to Great Britain to answer a simple question. Could Great Britain survive, the Nazi onslaught, or was it going to be occupied by the Germans? Donovan was given access to the highest levels of the British government, British intelligence, its commerce, defense, naval, everything. And he came back with a pile of documents to Roosevelt and reported back that, yes, Britain could survive the German attack, but it would need substantial American aid, which eventually came in the form of Lend-Lease. Then there was a second visit that occurred in late 1940, early 1941. Roosevelt sent Donovan again back to Europe as an unofficial envoy, this time not only to Great Britain, but also he took a tour of the Balkan states, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East, assessing the situation there, but also delivering a private message to Balkan and Middle East and Eastern European leaders that Franklin Roosevelt did not intend to let Great Britain lose this war. And if you, the Balkan leader or whatever, were still sitting on the fence deciding, you know, which side you were going to be on, and many of them still were on the fence, just keep in mind that the Allies are going to be the winning side. Churchill was delighted with this message. In fact, Churchill provided Donovan with a plane and a British escort to fly him around the region. One of his British escorts was Ian Fleming, the novel who later would write the James Bond novels. Mm. Back then, he was head of British intelligence. Roosevelt was delighted with the trip. The State Department wasn't too happy about it, because here was Donovan, who had no official standing in either the U.S. government or the British government, basically strong-arming Balkan and Eastern Europe leaders. And in fact, documents in the State Department show that they debated whether Donovan should be prosecuted for violating the Logan Act, which makes it a crime for a private U.S. citizen to negotiate on behalf of the U.S. government. Mm. But as I say, Roosevelt was only too delighted to have Donovan out there freelancing for him.
Well, then maybe the question is, was the information that Donovan provided Roosevelt, did that confirm something, or was that important for Roosevelt for him to act in a way that he was inclined to do, but was looking for more information to make sure that that was the right path? Or did that really make the difference between Roosevelt's deciding either to support the British or not?
It confirmed and reinforced what Roosevelt was already wanted to do, and it calmed his nerves to a degree, too. Roosevelt sent a lot of other private envoys out during this period, including Harry Hopkins, who was his senior counselor, to assess the same thing. Because you have to look, keep in mind the political situation at this point. 1940, Roosevelt is running for an unprecedented third term. He's very nervous he's going to lose that election to Wendell Willkie. And he's making major foreign policy decisions on, first off, how to circumvent congressional restrictions on aid to Great Britain. That could cost him the election. So he was deeply worried about these decisions and making them blind to really what lay ahead of him overseas. So Donovan was one of many important eyes and ears for him as he proceeded with these decisions.
All right. Let's talk with another caller here, someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. No, I'm in Urbana.
Pardon me. Well, go ahead.
We accept champagne once in a while.
Okay.
I want to remark, I was a very low-level person within the OSS just at the end of World War II, never got into any action. But my impression, even at the tender age of 18, was that really the OSS plans were sort of screwy, even the ones that I was to be on, that they were really more like Ian Fleming's James Bond than like real intelligence. The mission that I was supposedly training for, in retrospect, would have been totally suicidal. And I wondered what the author had to say about the relative success of OSS missions. I have read in another book that the success rate was extremely low, but I wonder what he thought, and I'll hang up.
All right. Well, that's an excellent question. What did the OSS actually manage to achieve?
It's a good question. And they had a number of off-the-wall missions and operations. Donovan was open to any idea. Some of them were kind of screwy. Some of them were very valuable in certain areas. The bottom line question is, did the OSS win the war for the Allies? And the short answer is no. Did it shorten the war appreciably? And again, the answer is no. But this is maybe pretty high bars to set for the OSS, because there were much broader factors that won the war for the Allies. The simple fact that the Allies could amass more military might, weapons, hardware, and manpower that the Axis could ever hope to battle against. The atomic bomb was a huge factor, particularly in Asia. But did the OSS contribute to the war? And the answer is yes. Just as the soldier at Normandy did, the sailor in the Pacific, and Rosie the Riveter in Los Angeles. There were a number of operations that succeeded for the OSS. There were a number that failed, too. It took Donovan's about 2 years to really get into the fight, to build up his organization and where he was actually accomplishing something. That sounds like a long time, but keep in mind, it took the U.S. Army a while to get into the fight, too, and build its organization up. So unprepared was it for World War II.
Well, I hope that gets to the question. Others are certainly welcome. We're talking this morning with Douglas Waller about his new biography of Bill Donovan, the man who headed the OSS during World War II. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
I've got the records that we used to share.
Roseanne Cash was 18 when her father, Johnny Cash, wrote a list of songs he thought she should know. On the next Fresh Air, we hear some of them and talk with Roseanne Cash. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for Focus comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982, with 4 area locations, inside the ARC, the Illini Student Union, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is available at bodyworkassociates.com.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. On Monday in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about Afghanistan with the journalist Edward Girardet, who spent a lot of time there, author of a new book, Killing the Cranes, A Reporter's Journey Through 3 Decades of War in Afghanistan. Also, we'll take questions on your back and back care. James Harms will be with us. He's an orthopedic surgeon at the Carl Spine Institute. That's the second hour. And also want to mention that next week, on Tuesday, we'll be having another conversation. I will have another conversation with the president of the University of Illinois, Michael Hogan. This is a live show. We'll be broadcast on Tuesday, 9 o'clock in the evening on WYLL-TV, also on AM and online. It's going to be live, and we'll be taking calls. And if you would like to submit a question in advance, you can do that as well by sending it to our email site, will-talk@illinois.edu. This morning in this hour of Focus, we are talking with Douglas Waller. He is a former correspondent for Newsweek and Time, and is the author of a new biography about Wild Bill Donovan, the man who was the head of the OSS during World War II. Wild Bill Donovan, that's the title. It's just out from the Free Press And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And I think that we have another caller here, someone in Pasodum on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Another fascinating topic. I was curious, I watch a lot of TV and stuff, and about the German engineers that came to the United States and the Soviet Union after the end of the war. Did Mr. Donovan have any part in helping collect them? And also, I remember a story about a man that was, I guess he was a soldier that was like dumped anonymously that had war plans or something, and the Germans retrieved him. And I don't remember the whole story about that, but was either of those any part of your book? And thank you, and I'll listen off air.
Okay.
On the last question, that was the deception operation. That wasn't run, that particular one, I think you may be talking about the Project Mincemeat, and there was other deception operations. Those were run by military intelligence. Donovan had a few deception operations before the North Africa landing in 1942, but there were other agencies that were running those. On the first question, a lot of the work bringing scientists back to the U.S. after the war, a lot of that was done by other agencies. But during the war, Donovan had a very active program to collect intelligence on German nuclear weapons research and capability, also on Italian nuclear weapons research and capability. And so he had, for example, one of his officers was Mo Berg, who was a famous pro baseball catcher before the war, who was an OSS officer that collected, gathered up Italian scientists, I believe, at one point, and brought them back to the U.S. And Berg and other people collected information on the scope of the German program and eventually concluded that the Germans were really far behind on their nuclear weapons research, which, of course, gratified the people who were running the Manhattan Project here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. He went in the course of doing the work that he did. He stepped on a lot of toes in Washington and made a lot of enemies. And probably the enemy number one, the man who was his worst enemy, was J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI. What was Hoover's problem with Donovan?
It began in the 1920s when Donovan was an assistant attorney general in the Coolidge administration, and at one point was Hoover's boss when Hoover was running, back then it was called the Bureau of Investigation, before it was called the FBI. And Donovan had a habit of meddling in Hoover's operation, overturning his decisions, which Hoover didn't appreciate. And so the two guys got off on the wrong foot, and it stayed on the wrong foot literally until the day Donovan died. Hoover thought Donovan's OSS was the biggest collection of amateurs he had ever seen assembled. And in fact, in the beginning, it was a collection of amateurs. Hoover spied on Donovan and his OSS. He had moles planted in the OSS that provided him information. Donovan spied on Hoover and Hoover's FBI and had moles in his FBI feeding him information. When I was doing the research on the book, I kind of joked to myself, when did they have time to spy on the Axis? They seemed to be spying on each other so much.
Well, they certainly did, and not only did they spy on each other, but the OSS spied on our allies as well. The OSS, they spied on the British. They spied on the Russians.
They did. Yeah, the British, the Russians, and the Chinese nationalists. Donovan had operations collecting information on all of them. The Russians, of course, spied on us. The Russians had moles in Donovan's organization. The British monitored Donovan closely. I went and reviewed a lot of the British material in their national archives in London, and it's clear that they kept very, very close tabs on what Donovan and his officers were up to. In China, Chiang Kai-shek, his intelligence chief, a guy named Tai Li, who the OSS nicknamed Chang's Himmler, had a very active spy operation that spied not only on Chinese dissidents, but also on Donovan's people, kept very, very close tabs on them.
He eventually, because he made a lot of enemies, and not just Hoover. He was the big one, but I'm sure that there are people who didn't think kindly about him in the State Department and also in the military. Really, I suppose the price Donovan paid. Now, it's arguable, I suppose, whether he would have in fact been the first director of the CIA. But really, the price was that at the end of the war, he was rather unceremoniously dumped. The OSS was closed down, and perhaps he had something to do with that. At least in not being terribly good at making friends and allies there in Washington.
Yeah, eventually Donovan's political enemies caught up with him. Donovan was already thinking ahead and had drafted a plan to form a post-war Central Intelligence Agency, and he wanted to head it. The plan, however, got leaked to the Washington Times Herald, a conservative Republican paper in Washington, and also the Chicago Tribune, part of the that chain, and that basically blew the plan out of the water. Donovan always suspected that Hoover leaked the plan to the Washington Times Herald. Roosevelt, after that story came out, and they published verbatim his secret order that he had drafted for Roosevelt on it. And the story accused Donovan of wanting to set up an American Gestapo. And back then, you accused anything of being Gestapo, and that pretty much killed it. Roosevelt shelved the plan. When Truman comes into office, Truman and Donovan didn't have a good relation. There was really bad karma between these two guys. They didn't really get along all that well. Hoover had one of his FBI agents plant a particularly nasty rumor with Truman's military aide that got passed on to Truman that Donovan was having an affair with his daughter-in-law. Now, I had to run that rumor to ground and found there was no evidence of that was the case. Donovan was very close to his daughter-in-law, but only as a daughter-in-law. Even so, Donovan had a number of affairs over the years. He had a number of mistresses, and it was common knowledge in Washington and OSS circles and military intelligence and FBI circles. So it didn't take long to get to Hoover. That really wasn't sunk it with Truman. What probably really did was a 59-page report that was drafted by a secret intelligence unit out of Army intelligence, which accused Donovan's organization of all manner of misdeeds and corruption and incompetence. And in fact, it accused Donovan's agents of staging a sex orgy in India at one point, which I found was no evidence was the case. That 59-page report managed to get to Truman's desk, and I think that's probably what really turned Truman sour to Donovan and his OSS.
Yeah, so Truman certainly knew that he needed an intelligence service. He apparently just didn't want Donovan or the OSS to have anything to do with it.
Oh, absolutely. Truman wasn't naive or blind to the threats that lay ahead of him overseas. He knew he needed a spy service, but as you say, he didn't want Donovan or his OSS to be any part of it.
Yeah, so in the fall of 1945, Truman shut down the OSS. Just 2 years later, he formed the CIA, and it actually looked a lot like what Donovan had laid out.
It was. It was remarkably like what the vision Donovan had for the organization. Donovan still wanted to lead the CIA then, and in fact, he had surrogates lobby Truman to make him CIA director, but Truman wasn't going to have any part of that.
Yeah, Donovan still had hopes about heading the CIA when Dwight Eisenhower became president, but apparently Eisenhower wasn't too keen on Donovan either.
No, in 1953, when Eisenhower came in, Donovan thought he had his best chance to lead the CIA. Eisenhower was a Republican. Eisenhower liked the work Donovan's OSS had done in Europe when he was a European commander. But Eisenhower made Alan Dulles his CIA director. Dulles had been Donovan's station chief in Bern. He ran his OSS station in Bern, Switzerland, and done a terrific job there. Even so, Donovan was bitter about not getting that appointment. He thought Dulles was a poor administrator and would do a terrible job of running the CIA. Ironically, Dulles always thought Donovan was a poor administrator of the OSS, and he'd have done a better job running the OSS.
Yeah, and Dulles was just one of several people who had worked for Donovan at OSS who did, in fact, later go on to become heads of CIA.
And that's a really an important legacy of Donovan and the OSS. It became, or it was, the petri dish that nurtured a lot of officers and senior leaders that would run the CIA later. So you had a number of CIA directors, Alan Dulles, William Colby, Richard Helms, Bill Casey, all of them cut their teeth on intelligence and were OSS officers under Donovan.
So apparently Eisenhower, even though he didn't have any inclination to make Donovan head of CIA, he apparently felt he owed him something and did name Donovan the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Thailand.
Yeah, that was the consolation prize. He appointed him ambassador to Thailand. Interestingly, Donovan wanted to expand that role so he would become a kind of a regional super envoy over all of Asia and have his own plane, be restored to his general's rank, and fly all over the world setting policy in Asia. John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles's brother, wanted no part of having a second Secretary of State for Asia, and neither did Eisenhower. And they told him, no, you're only going to be the ambassador to Thailand. Well, when he got out there, and he only served for a year, he made himself kind of the regional envoy despite the prohibition. He would just fly around the region and pay for it with his law firm account instead of having the State Department do it.
And that's, I guess, it's something that has always been a stamp of his personality. And again, going back to his time at OSS, the reason that he did make a lot of enemies was if he wanted to do something and he was told no, he'd find some way to do it.
He never really took no for an answer. So, for example, a commander in front of him would say, no, I can't do this or you can't do it. He had a habit of making end runs around him and going to the commander on top of him to get the decision reversed. That doesn't win you many friends in the Pentagon. He would, for example, show up at Pentagon meetings, his uniform would always be immaculately tailored from Wetzel's in New York. And very often he would only wear his Medal of Honor on his uniform. As a not-so-subtle reminder to the other flag officers in the room, the admirals and generals with their rows of ribbon, all that fruit salad, that he had the only medal that really counted.
Yeah. We're coming down to the point we have a few minutes left in this hour of the show, about 5-6 minutes left. I'd just like to mention again that our guest is Douglas Waller, and we're talking about what you will find, and there are a lot of great stories in this book, what you'll find in his book, Wild Bill Donovan, The Spy Master Who Created the OSS and Modern American Espionage, and it's published by the Free Press. We talked a little bit earlier about this very long-standing animosity between Donovan and Hoover. It's sad in Donovan's life. It's sad that at the end of his life he suffered from dementia. Hoover at that time still hadn't given up on his campaign against him and spread this ugly rumor that that Donovan was suffering from syphilis.
Yeah, that was the last thing that he spread around. Hoover and his senior advisors were worried after Donovan's death that there'd be a lot of movies and publicity out extolling Donovan as OSS and also extolling the CIA, which was still a bureaucratic rival with the FBI at that point. And Hoover kept a dossier on Donovan. It's numbers about over 750 pages, and he kept it literally until the day Donovan died. Kept tabs on what he was doing.
I'm sure that there are a lot of other interesting people who come into the story. I guess I just would like to have you talk a little bit about an inventor, a man that worked for Donovan, a man named Stanley Lovell, who was, when you read about this guy, you think, well, this is Q. This is the man that we have seen in all of the James Bond stories, the guy who comes up with all the gadgets. Well, there actually was a guy like this, and he did come up with a bunch of gadgets.
Stanley Lovell. He was actually a famous New England inventor in his own right, and he was head of Donovan's research and development operation. Donovan used to call him his Professor Moriarty after the Sherlock Holmes character. Lovell invented all kinds of gadgets, you know, pistols with silencers, pencil-like explosive devices, miniature cameras. Donovan, for example, was very, very interested in truth drugs. So Stanley Lovell had truth drugs tested on an unwitting mafia mobster in New York, a guy named Little Augie. They laced his cigarettes with truth drugs, and it worked with Little Augie, an OSS officer who had been a police officer and busted him in the past, fed him the cigarettes. And Little Augie talked about, as he puffed away, all the mob hits he'd carried out working for Lucky Luciano and all the congressmen he'd bribed. Of course, Little Augie's secrets were safe with the OSS because they couldn't bring him to court or they would reveal that they were administering him truth drugs. But Donovan, again, along with Lovell, was interested in all kinds of exotic gadgets that Lovell could produce.
Yeah, and that does, I guess I find myself thinking about the earlier caller from the fellow who said that he actually was, near the end of the war, was in the OSS, and he regarded a lot of the plans as being kind of wacky at best. And certainly there were a lot of things, a lot of wacky things that they thought to do when you do hear the story and you think, really? Like, for example, tell the story about the assault on Hitler's mustache.
Oh, yeah. One of the schemes Stanley Lovell concocted was they concocted a female hormone that if they could find Hitler's vegetables and inject this hormone into the vegetables, it would give him a falsetto voice and make his mustache fall off, which would certainly be a bummer for the Fuhrer. But again, you know, they were never able to, you know, pull that kind of idea out. But Donovan was open to any wild scheme. Interestingly, so was Franklin Roosevelt. He didn't mind Donovan going out there and being kind of the idea guy who thought out of the box.
Yeah, it's interesting there again. You know, you talked a little bit about the relationship between Donovan and Truman, and about how these guys were certainly very different, and they just didn't mesh. They just were complete opposites. Well, there were certainly a lot of differences between Roosevelt and Donovan as well. At least they certainly came from different social strata and early in their lives. But it does seem that despite the whatever differences they had, and I'm sure they had political differences, that they seemed to get along pretty well. Or maybe it was that Roosevelt really appreciated the utility of the kind of information that Donovan gave him.
And it was. They did get along. It was a complicated relationship because politically they were on opposite sides. Donovan was Roosevelt's idea man, as I say, who thought out of the box. Although Donovan was never a member of Roosevelt's inner war council. You know, he wasn't part of, you know, the small group, Harry Hopkins, George Marshall, Admiral King, Hap Arnold of the Air Forces, who advised Roosevelt. Donovan also didn't want to get too close personally to Roosevelt. He wanted to keep it more on a business relationship. And interestingly, in later years, he thought Roosevelt was a superb political leader. He was actually critical of Roosevelt as a wartime leader, and I think he was unfair in his assessment.
Mm. What as a person, what kind of you know, if you hadn't known him personally, you got the chance to hang out with him, what kind of a guy was Wild Bill Donovan?
He was fascinating. He was only about 5'9" tall. One of his agents, Mary Bancroft, said he was kind of penguin-shaped when he ran the OSS, which he didn't really appreciate all that much. He slept about 3 to 5 hours a night, could speed read three books a week. He loved to sing Irish songs. In fact, he would go to New York and Broadway and buy up the latest sheet music so he could learn it. He was an excellent ballroom dancer. He had bright blue eyes that women found absolutely absolutely captivating. And his life was actually filled with personal tragedy. His daughter died in college in an automobile accident. His daughter-in-law died of a drug overdose. And one of his granddaughters died at 4 years old when she accidentally swallowed silver polish.
So can you, just as we're coming down to our last couple of minutes, I know that you said in response to an earlier question about the effectiveness of the OSS that you can't say that the OSS made the difference between winning the war and not winning the war, that it and the people who worked for it and the information that it turned up certainly made their contributions. Can you point to anything though in particular that you thought was particularly big and significant that OSS did?
Yes, in the North Africa campaign, the torch invasion of North Africa in November 1942, the OSS provided a lot of good military intelligence on the Vichy French forces that Eisenhower force faced. The OSS mounted considerable operations in the Balkans, in Yugoslavia and Greece, supplying the partisan guerrillas there. In Italy, the OSS had a lot of problems with its operations there, a lot of personnel problems. But keep in mind, Mark Clark's Fifth Army had a lot of problems conquering Italy, too. In northern France, the OSS supplied a lot of intelligence for the Normandy invasion. OSS officers, special operations commandos, parachuted into France to hook up with the French resistance. Some of them were called Jedburgh commandos after the site in Scotland where they trained. In Asia, the OSS didn't do anything in the Pacific theater, but it had operations in China that it took a while to get off the ground, but eventually started mounting credible operations toward the end of the war. And in Burma, the OSS had a very significant commando operation, even though that was really a side theater in the war.
Yeah. And as far as the shape of the CIA goes, can you point to something that you say, this is really, the CIA is the way it is in this respect, really, and that was what Donovan had in mind?
Yeah, the organization of the CIA into a clandestine force, the CIA's Directorate of Intelligence, and even its special operations group in the CIA all mirror the type of operations that Donovan had in his OSS. So he really is the father of modern espionage. He's also considered the father of modern special operations. So if you go down to the U.S. Special Operations Command headquartered in Tampa, Florida, they consider Donovan their intellectual father there. He's also the father of modern information warfare, propaganda, psychological operations that you see today. In Donovan's day, he did it with much cruder forms of newspapers, rumors, and radio. But a lot of his concepts endure to this day.
Yeah, well, it's a great story, and there's much more in the book about specific things that the OSS did. So if people want to read more, look for the book Wild Bill Donovan, The Spy Master Who Created the OSS and Modern American Espionage by our guest Douglas Waller. He's a former correspondent for Newsweek and Time. And Mr. Waller, thanks very much.
Good talking to you.
Can you point to something that you say, this is really, the CIA is the way it is in this respect, really, and that was what Donovan had in mind?
Yeah, the organization of the CIA into a clandestine force, the CIA's Directorate of Intelligence, and even its special operations group in the CIA all mirror the type of operations that Donovan had in his OSS. So he really is the father of modern espionage. He's also considered the father of modern special operations. So if you go down to the U.S. Special Operations Command headquartered in Tampa, Florida, they consider Donovan their intellectual father there. He's also the father of modern information warfare, propaganda, psychological operations that you see today. In Donovan's day, he did it with much cruder forms of newspapers, rumors, and radio. But a lot of his concepts endure to this day.
Yeah, well, it's a great story, and there's much more in the book about specific things that the OSS did. So if people want to read more, look for the book Wild Bill Donovan, The Spy Master Who Created the OSS and Modern American Espionage by our guest Douglas Waller. He's a former correspondent for Newsweek and Time. And Mr. Waller, thanks very much.
Good talking to you.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
That's it for us here on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, September wheat trading at 817.5, up 22.5. December 841.75, up 22.25. September wheat in Chicago 731, up 23.25. December 761, up 21.75. September corn 712, up 13. December 726.5, up 13.5. March 739.25, up 13.25. May 744.5, up 14.5. September soybeans 1363.25, up 11.25. November 1372.75, up 11.75. January 1382.75, up 11. March 1387, up 10.